It is 8:32, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jop Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Well, plenty of things to cover. And
yeah, it was a week rich in irony, and not just as of the 9/11 anniversary, but I'll try not to veer off into unwarranted sarcasm too often.
All right, that'll
warranted sarcasm, however.
Well, the starting with the Supreme Court of Washington State elections.
Some interesting developments there. We've been getting a real sleaze campaign from John Groen, who's the actually not very well-respected lawyer that is being backed by the Building Industry Association of Washington, for whom Groen has actually worked for a number of years. And an ethics violation has been filed against Groen and the BIAW because the BIAW has been disguising its involvement in so-called independent PACs that aren't supposed to be able to coordinate their TV ads and other campaign activities with the Groen campaign. He's running against 30-year incumbent Chief Justice Jerry Alexander for the state Supreme Court. Well, given that Groen has worked for the BIAW, knows all those folks, sits on a couple of their boards and so forth, there's a fair presumption that they're coordinating activities. And the BIAW alone has put something like $1.3 million into this race. It's an absolutely unprecedented kind of expenditure. The other couple of Supreme Court races, as I've mentioned when we went over the ballot a couple weeks ago, are also being attacked by conservative Republicans to try and stack the state Supreme Court. And Alexander is not a particularly liberal judge either. The thing is, he's not a longtime property rights advocate the way Groen is. And they've already got a couple of BIAW, that is, their folks elected to the Supreme Court. So they're hoping essentially to get a majority this time. So when you vote on Tuesday, not if, but when, if you haven't voted already, remember Jerry Alexander. Please vote for him. Susan Owens, also an incumbent under attack, and Tom Chambers, who's running against the dreadful Jeanette Barrage. But that ethics complaint hopefully will be acted on between now and Tuesday, but the ads are everywhere, and they've probably done a fair amount of damage. Alexander needs all the help he can get.
All right. Well, speaking of under attack, Lieutenant Aaron Watata has another charge added to those against him.
Yeah, the Veterans for Peace Conference in Seattle last month, Watata was a featured speaker, and in front of all the cameras, he called for other soldiers in and being deployed to Iraq to resist that deployment to what he terms an illegal war. For calling for that resistance, he is now facing an eighth charge, an additional possible year in the brig. On the GI resistance front, however, a positive development this week, which has not, I don't think, yet widely been reported, which is that thanks to occupations in his D.C. and home offices and a flood of letters and phone calls and emails, Representative Peter DeFazio of Central Oregon, where Suzanne Swift was actually arrested after having gone AWOL. She was arrested in June, is now being held in Fort Lewis. For people not familiar with her case, she alleges that her commanding officers in Iraq, when she served a tour of duty there, sexually harassed and, in the case of three of her commanders, sexually harassed and at least one of them raped her pretty much for the duration of her tour of duty. She went AWOL from PTSD over the incidents, and rather than investigate what she went through, she is now under arrest and waiting court-martial. DeFazio's office has agreed to launch a congressional investigation of her case. And not just her case, but also this highlights the issue of sexual violence in the armed forces, which is really a very serious and underreported problem. So that's actually a very positive development.
Oh, very good. All right. And King County is looking at some oversight for the sheriff.
Yeah, the Blue Ribbon panel that was launched by Sheriff Sue Rahr of the King County Sheriff's Office a few months ago, rather than the county council proposal that was put forward by Ferguson and Patterson to have an independent review office, that Blue Ribbon panel came back with its report in remarkably quick time, actually, on Monday, issued a number of recommendations. Probably the most notable of them was that it indeed recommended an office of independent oversight, and there are at least eight of the nine county council members have said they would vote for such an office of independent oversight. Only Reagan Dunn, who, of course, is the son of Jennifer, has said he's not sure how he would vote. As for the other recommendations, Ron Sims has already come out and said that there's no way they can do all of them because they would just be too expensive. And Dave Reichert, under whose watch many of these problems first manifested themselves, came out with a kind of a blowhard press statement late in the week saying, well, I didn't do any of this. I did a great job. Reichert, remember, was being visited by Karl Rove, who was raising funds for him yesterday, and hopefully that was a nice boost for the nice boost to the treasury of Darcy Berner also, because goodness knows, and Maria Cantwell, to her credit, actually did a fundraising letter for Berner around Rove's visit. Goodness knows Reichert's record as sheriff was pretty bad, and if that is coming out now, it can only be good news for Berner.
All right, well, and sticking with the campaign circuit, Mike McGavick is looking for testing for substance abuse.
Yeah. Like I said, it was an irony-rich week. Mike McGavick, in one of the only policy pronouncements the man has made during his entire year-long campaign for the Senate, I mean, aside from the fact that he lines up with the Bush administration on virtually everything, but he doesn't particularly like to say so in front of the cameras because those are losing propositions in Washington State. So he campaigns not on civility, not on being civil, because he's already been censured for, you know, misleading radio ads, but he's campaigning on a campaign to be civil, if that makes any sense. So he comes out finally with a policy pronouncement. He wants welfare mothers to be tested for drugs. Now, this, I really can't think of an idea. I mean, aside from the fact that it's grotesquely unconstitutional, I really can't, and completely unnecessary, I really can't think of a proposal that could push more pandering buttons at once. Maybe if he had said drug testing for, oh, I don't know, non-white illegal alien women on welfare, maybe that would have done well. But, you know, it really shows how desperate McGavick has become. The latest polls that have come out show Cantwell widening her lead quite a bit. And, God, I hope that helps widen it some more, because it's a really stupid and actually in some ways kind of alarming proposal, not to mention deeply ironic.
Yeah, maybe they should have substance abuse testing for, like, CEOs, since these are the people supposedly driving the economy.
Yes, and particularly since McGavick has said that he still drinks and drives. Kind of alarming, and this man wants to be in the U.S. Senate.
All right. Well, jumping to national, Bush and Cheney, hand in hand this week.
Yes, they made a rare trip to Capitol Hill. Now, what one particular issue could be so near and dear to the Bush administration that both the president and the vice president at the same time would go to Capitol Hill to lobby for it? You guessed it, the right to torture. It seems to be the only thing that really exercises this president, along with stem cells. You know, maybe if they had a lot of torture stem cells. In any event, the four Republicans joined the Democrats on the Senate Armed Services Committee and ignored both Bush and Cheney. Those Republicans obviously feeling a need to distance themselves from an unpopular administration, and passed an alternative proposal that would not allow the Army and armed forces to torture people, would not allow hearsay evidence and secondhand evidence and secret evidence to be used in military tribunals. This for the legislation that's trying to shore up the military tribunals that were thrown out as unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. Unfortunately, the House Republican leadership has said that they're going to go right along with the Bush administration's desires to redefine the Geneva Conventions and torture. So we'll see how that irons out. Probably not until the session next year.
All right. Abramoff, how about an update there?
Yeah, Robert Nye, the disgraced Ohio congressman who has withdrawn from re-election bid, is reported to be ready to plead guilty to unspecified criminal charges. It is the first congressperson after nearly a year of investigation that is going to be pleading guilty of Abramoff. Of course, Tom DeLay is actually in more legal trouble this week also. I won't go into that, but he could be snagged in this too, and there's a number of others, of course, on under investigation, but Nye finally is the first, and isn't it nice that it took until nearly the 2006 elections for it to happen?
All right. Well, speaking of things taking a while to happen, Michael Powell generated a report some years back that saw the light of day this week.
Yeah. Pete Tridish, I think, mentioned this at the 7:30 hour, but the FCC in 2003, during the their rulemaking to try and expand ownership limits, apparently spiked a study that was done by their own staff that showed that local ownership actually leads to more TV news content. The FCC was trying to make the opposite argument that large corporations had more resources and therefore did more local news content, and that didn't agree with their ideology, so they just simply killed the report. Why is this relevant now with a new chairman and different composition on the commission? Well, because they're going through yet another rulemaking proposal and public hearings to try once again to lift ownership limits. So keep a close eye on that, and maybe it's time to start filing Freedom of Information Act requests for any, you know, other studies that might be being done by FCC staff at the moment.
All right. And moving along the economy, the foreign trade deficit, how are things doing there?
Not good. And this is a little bit of economic news that didn't see a lot of headlines this week. The U.S. trade deficit for July reached record levels. $820 billion a year is the current rate. That's double the federal budget deficit and also a record 6% of the gross domestic product. And what it means basically is that, you know, China and other countries, particularly Japan, Korea, are financing our economy, and they could really call in their cards anytime they want. That, I think, along with global warming, probably actually much more threats to our national security than the terrorism we were hearing so much about this week. Again, an ironic week.
All right. Well, obviously, we have an election here in the state on Tuesday, primary, and everybody's looking at some elections come November. But in other states, they're having a little problem with some of the voter ID issues.
Yeah. Republicans have been launching a campaign in a number of states around the country. Well, actually, they've been launching campaigns to try and take over the courts. What's going on in Washington State, the Supreme Court level, has been going on in other states for years, not just the Supreme Court level, but Superior Court and even district courts. What we're talking about here is voter ID laws, IDs that require proof of citizenship or a driver's license or other things that are particularly likely to disqualify the elderly, the disabled, the poor, people who traditionally vote Democratic. And these have been challenged in court pretty much everywhere they've been tried. They've been tried now in seven states. Four states, courts have blocked them, at least for the 2006 election. Three states, Indiana, Arizona, and Mexico, they're going ahead. Arizona, a judge refused to block it this week. In Missouri, they did block it this week in court. And there's one other state, Wisconsin, where the governor keeps vetoing a legislation passed by a Republican legislature. And so the Republicans have put it on the ballot in November as a constitutional amendment. So this is something that we're probably going to be seeing more of heading into the 2008 election, something that's pretty worrisome in the states where it's already happening. And the court record on it, unfortunately, has been only mixed at this point.
Mm-hmm. All right, moving along to international, what's been happening this week in Iraq?
Quite a bit. The Iraqi National Guard and Army, probably at the behest of the U.S. Embassy that is covering 21 buildings and God knows how many square miles, is announced a new plan for the security of Baghdad. They are going to dig trenches surrounding the city, basically a moat, except they don't have any water there, or fresh water. I mean, I think you mentioned before we went on the air, maybe they can fill it with all the blood that's being spilled. And they'll set up checkpoints at the roads. Now this, mind you, they're going to set up a trench around a metropolis of 5+ million people. Probably not that many now. We'll get to that in a minute. But it just shows you how desperate they are, particularly since the violence is going on just as much outside Baghdad in the surrounding regions as it is in Baghdad itself. So it's not entirely, you know, you're just going to have people on both sides killing each other. I'm not really sure what it's supposed to accomplish. As if to back up the fact that things are getting worse rather than better, almost 200 have died in Baghdad in the last 3 days alone. The U.S. troops in Baghdad, it was also mentioned that this week that have been deployed there to almost no effect mostly came from Anbar province. Why did they come from Anbar province? Because the province now, which is the Sunni triangle, which is the area that has been resisted most fiercely, is almost entirely outside U.S. control. That includes the cities of Ramadi and Fallujah, and apparently Fallujah is under brutally heavy attack once again. It's really hard to believe anybody still lives in Fallujah because it's been flattened so many times now by the U.S. And is it any wonder we're not particularly popular there? Interesting statistic on how popular the U.S. is anymore in Iraq. It used to be that the vast majority of Iraqis basically wanted peace, and you know, just the overeager young men were doing most of the killing. But the majority didn't want civil war. They didn't want to see anybody die. They didn't even want to see U.S. soldiers die. So the U.S. would get a lot of tips as to imminent attacks by or bombings or whatever. There were 5,900 of those tips in April. In July, the last month for which we now have statistics, 3,700. So they're not even tipping off the Americans anymore that they're about to be attacked, which says an awful lot. Meanwhile, they might not be being attacked as much, and Baghdad might have not have 5 million people anymore, because 2 million people have left Iraq this summer because of all the violence and killing and insecurity. That's almost impossible to believe. It's 1/12 of the entire population of the country has fled just in the last 3 months. That would be the equivalent of 25 million people in the United States. Or if you want to think of it this way, start with Washington and Oregon and go east until you hit Lake Michigan, all the way from here to Milwaukee. Depopulate that entire area so there's not one single person left in it. That would be a little bit under 25 million people. We can also welcome Iraq finally into the very small list, along with the United States, of purported democracies that exercise capital punishment. Iraq this week held its first mass execution since the days of Saddam Hussein. 27 people killed for alleged crimes against the state. Of course, the Interior Ministry, again, this is an ironic week, the Interior Ministry has been pretty central in running the death squads that have been targeting and executing thousands of Sunnis over the past couple of years, but that's not using courts or due process of the law, so I guess that doesn't really count.
All right. Update on what's happening in Israel, Palestine, and Lebanon.
Prime Minister Omer in Israel is in trouble. He's facing a no-confidence vote for his handling of the Lebanon war. In Palestine, another major development this week, Mahmoud Abbas, also known as Abu Mazen, the head of the Fatah party, and the leaders of Hamas, those who are not in jail, agreed on a so-called unity government that would hopefully end the really pretty vicious economic blockade that's been launched by the U.S. and Israel, in particular over the last number of months, that has left the vast majority of the 1.4 million people in Gaza in danger of starvation and facing a real severe humanitarian crisis, and all other sorts of problems that have been associated with that are on health care and payment and employment and the economy collapsing and so forth. The U.S., of course, is resistant to lifting those sanctions and urge, quote-unquote, caution in considering the new unity government. Speaking of the Hamas leaders in jail, 21 of those lawmakers were released on bail by an Israeli military court this week. That includes 3 MPs and 1 minister. No reason was given for their having been released after 3 months. The head of the IDF's rocket unit stated this week that Israel used a whopping 1,800 cluster bombs in its bombing of Lebanon. Most of those bombs, of course, fell in the last few hours before the ceasefire, meaning that the vast majority of those munitions, 90%, fell in those last 72 hours. 70% of those did not explode because they were old munitions, meaning that that huge number of cluster bombs was intended to explode after refugees were trying to come back to southern Lebanon. 1.2 million bomblets being dropped in Lebanon. And again, 90% of that would mean 1.08 million, doing the math quickly, were dropped just before the ceasefire.
Moving on, Iran.
A couple of major developments there. Something that should have been on the front pages on 9/11, but wasn't. It did have to do, after all, with both weapons of mass destruction and terror. Iran offered to negotiators of the European Union last weekend that they would freeze uranium enrichment for 8 weeks in order to conduct negotiations with the U.S. and EU over that issue. That basically meets the U.S.'s precondition for negotiations. The U.S. Wanted Iran to stop the uranium enrichment before it would enter into negotiations. Stop, freeze, suspend. Since you can start again at any time, if you stop, Iran's offer is actually better because it offers a guaranteed period of time in which they would stop. But not only no response from the White House, but virtually no mention in U.S. media. Meanwhile, the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, agency of the UN, blasted Peter Hoekstra's House Intelligence Committee report on Iran, the one that I mentioned a couple weeks ago that was sort of attempted to preempt the national intelligence estimate that the CIA is trying to produce on Iran. It blasted Hoekstra's report as, quote, outrageous and dishonest. Hoekstra, of course, trying to make the case basically for an invasion.
All right. And it looks like there's some efforts internationally to develop a nuclear weapons-free zone.
Yeah. The Central Asia, the countries of Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan have committed themselves to a nuclear-free zone in Central Asia. They signed that agreement this week. The U.S. and the Bush administration, amazingly, is opposing this. Even though, you know, that's a central terror breeding ground, and you would think that they wouldn't want nuclear weapons to be falling into terrorist hands. But basically, they want to curry favor with Russia, and Russia is claiming the right to deploy nuclear weapons in its former republics. Of course, the Bush administration also dismantled the ABM treaty, so their record on weapons of mass destruction actually isn't particularly good. And, of course, they're also aligning themselves with Pakistan and supplying nukes to India. So, and haven't particularly cared about Pakistan's having supplied nuclear materials and knowledge to Iran, Libya, and North Korea. So this is sort of just another nail in the coffin of the Bush administration's record on WMDs. But it's still pretty disappointing because that really is a pretty critical area in the war on terror.
Well, as well, U.S. forces couldn't really go into an area without, which was a nuclear-free zone, because they always have a policy of neither confirming nor denying that they're bringing in nuclear weapons. World Bank has got a report.
Yeah, the World Bank weighed in on the anniversary of 9/11, and interestingly enough, it was virtually the only mention that I saw in U.S. mainstream media this week was this Washington Post article on a World Bank report. It was the only mention that I saw of what causes terrorism. All the ink, all the airtime, all the column inches that were spent on terrorism this week in the anniversary of 9/11, nobody bothering to ask why. The World Bank came up with an answer. Its report said poverty and conflict would seem kind of common sense. It isn't, amazingly enough, because they're born intrinsically evil. But if you kind of look at that, well, poverty, the U.S. has been pushing neoliberal policies for, you know, decades that have increased the income gaps in much of the developing world. And conflict, the U.S. is by far the world's largest arms trade dealer. And of course, now we're launching preemptive invasions wherever we feel like it. That's our official foreign policy. So you look at the Bush administration's desires for how to handle stopping terrorism, and according to the World Bank, they're causing terrorism. It was an ironic week.
All right. And plenty of events coming up this weekend.
Of course, the one that Pete was talking about at 7:30 and that I'm scurrying right over to after we get off the air here, the Northwest Community Radio Summit happening on Capitol Hill. That's going on all day today and tomorrow morning. Registration is at Capitol Hill Arts Center. And the keynote for that tonight at 7 p.m. at Town Hall, Amy Goodman. I understand that is sold out, but you can probably scalp tickets at the door or just, you know, ignore the fire marshal and storm your way in.
And if I could jump in for a sec,
sure.
There, one of the highlights,
the lunch plenary,
yeah. Which is on hip hop culture and the struggle for media democracy, is supposed to be especially good. It's going to have like 10 panelists.
Yeah, right? Charles Mudede, I think, is leading that, and there's some very, very good people on that panel.
So that's going to be at noontime at the Capitol Hill Arts Center at 1621 12th Avenue.
Yeah, that is basically right down the street from the it's just north of Pike, down from the police station and two doors down from the liquor store. they do know those community radio people do not a party. Also, of course, we have the primary coming up on next Tuesday. So if you haven't voted, be sure to do so. Again, the Supreme Court race is by far the most important on the ballot. Tom Chambers, Jerry Alexander, Susan Owens, please support them. They need help to fend off a conservative challenge from what's supposed to be a nonpartisan office. And also the hotly contested 43rd District State Rep race, in which there are six people vying for that office. Three of them are pretty good. I endorse Lynn Dawson. Dodson. She's having a couple of events tomorrow. They need people at the Capitol Hill Farmers Market from 11 to 3, and then they're doing, phone banking or something like that the campaigns do at 417 Pine from 6 to 8:30. And, of course, all the campaigns are doing their last-minute stuff. So get out and help, and then go out and vote on Tuesday if you haven't already.
All right. And then Wednesday is Japan Dolphin Day.
Yes.
They're going to be a protest in front of the Japanese consulate because Japan is looking at killing over 20,000 dolphins and porpoises in the near future. So
not intentionally, just because they're there.
Yeah. So that's at noontime at the Consulate General of Japan here in Seattle, which is at 601 Union Street. So if you want more info on that, they can go to orcanetwork.org.
Very good.
Talking, as we do every week, with Job Parrish, co-editor of Eat the State. And quickly, where can people find Eat the State?
Eat the State is in its 10th anniversary as of this past week. We had a great anniversary issue that came out this week. Please pick it up because we printed a bunch of them. 16 pages, all stuff from the last 10 years. Last issue, of course, had our election endorsements. That's available on the web also. You can find any of it on the web at www.eatthestate.org or anywhere where you find free periodicals. If you have comments, tips, feedback, want to volunteer, want to donate, we always welcome any of that. It's a community effort, volunteer effort. Give us a call. Our voicemail area code 206-719-6947.